current events. Kind of a broad topic. Many areas we can cover. All we know is what we see in the overhead right now. The Elohim of Yahweh are extremely busy seeing that events come about to bring about that great day of God Almighty. And as we watch these latter-day events unfold, the world, in their misunderstanding for some of this, look for a cataclysmic happening, and there certainly will be some. But the world, perhaps, and some in the household are being caught unawares of how the Elohim are orchestrating these events. Nation conquering nation through military might is not what we're seeing yet, but it will be. Today, Gog and Persia are walking into Syria to help that dictatorial government eliminate ISIS. Of course, there are wars, but examine how those wars are facilitating the preparation for Armageddon. To begin with, we want to look at events or the croakings of the frog-like spirits in relation to the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. We read in Revelation the 16th chapter, verse 13, "And I saw three unclean spirit-like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet." Verse 14 goes on, "For they are all spirits of devil, or evil spirits, working miracles which go forth unto the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty." Harsh croakings of these frogs typically represent the harbinger of spring. Springtime, a symbol of birth and renewal. The croaking of these frog-like spirits of the apocalypse are harbingers of the return of our Lord and the resurrection. Those frog-like voices are harsh and coarse. Their verbose, long-winded chatterings tear at the very fabric of the kingdom of men. Their agitations are heard throughout the earth, deluding and seducing the minds of men. Three frog-like spirits coming out of three symbolic entities. Three, the number of completion, indicating that what we have symbolized here represents all the philosophies, the sciences, the learning of the kingdom of men, predominantly symbolized in these three scriptural beast or beast systems, the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. Currently, we view the executive mouths of these three creatures are manifested by one, Vladimir Putin, the dragon, the autocrat of Russia. Two, Jean-Claude Juncker, who happens to be the president of the European Commission, which is the executive branch of the European Union. But the real power is manifesting itself in a shadowy European fixer, cabinet chief Martin Selmayr, a German. He was the president's cabinet chief, but now he holds the position of Secretary General of the EU, in charge of the Commission's 33,000 employees. He's known in the EU as the monster, and he's behind the campaign to punish Britain for cutting their ties with the EU. 46 years old, and he's been branded a poisonous, merciless, ruthless, manipulative bully, and that's by his fellow nation members. He is known to destroy those who fall foul of his boss, Juncker, and revels in that sinister reputation he now has. And finally, the false prophet, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, alias Pope Francis. These systems will come to be unified with one common purpose. Claim the land of Israel and Jerusalem for universal goodwill and equity of mankind at the expense of the total destruction of the seed of Abraham, even the children of Jacob, his chosen. So the croaking has been described in three particular words that we all know: liberty, equality, and fraternity. The spirit of the kingdom of men, which came out of the French Revolution. The insanity, the madness, which is overtaking the nations, just as it did in the days of Jeremiah. Chapter 25 of Jeremiah, we read, "For thus saith Yahweh Elohim of Israel unto me, take the wine cup of this fury at my hand, and cause all nations to whom I send thee to drink it, and they shall drink it and be moved and be mad because of the sword that I will send among them." In chapter 51, in particular, Babylon hath been a golden cup in Yahweh's hand that made all the earth drunken. The nations have drunken of her wine. Therefore, the nations are mad. But know this, it's the Elohim working to bring about that gathering of nations to the war of the great day of God Almighty, just as it was to come upon the nations in Jeremiah's day, making sure the croaking of these frog-like spirits are heard throughout the earth. So as we look at current events in relation to those three wild beast systems, their mouthpieces in particular, we understand that appearances can be deceiving. The EU is currently in a great deal of turmoil. They are not unified. They are not in one position. If anything, the Pope and Putin are on better terms than with the others. So, recent headlines. We saw this one last year. Vatican tries to help portray itself as a bulwark of traditional values in constant secularized Europe. It deals with, that article dealt with the Vatican influence at the G20 summit conference. But Putin and Francis have met several times, which has served the dragon and the false prophet greatly. The photo ops with the Pope strengthening the Russian president's attempt to present Russia as a stronghold of Christianity, working to save a corrupt Western civilization from globalization without values. An effort that has sparked a debate in the Catholic world about whether Russia can indeed provide such a solution. Meanwhile, in Russia, Russian conservatives have even resurrected the Tsarist rhetoric that Moscow is a third Rome, a center for imperial Christianity. For the Roman Catholic Church, tighter ties with Moscow are an opportunity to reestablish a stronger presence after a century marked by the rise and fall of communism and enforced atheism. Full diplomatic relations between Moscow and the Vatican were restored in 2009. What can this growth in relations do? Well, the Vatican Insider website states that it will strengthen the Pope's desire to unify Christians. How about that? In February of 2016, there was a meeting between Francis and the Russian Patriarch Kirill. They had it at the Havana airport, and it marked the first meeting between the Moscow Patriarch and a Pope since the Eastern Orthodox Church broke away from Rome in 1054 A.D. The meeting took almost 20 years to set up. But now we have joint declarations coming out. The Russian cleric stated, "Now things are easier." And the Argentine Pope replied, "It's clear that this is God's will, and I don't think he knows how right he is." Another headline, Vladimir Putin cultivates friendship with the Pope in attempts to get one over on the EU. Here was another headline that appeared this past August in the Daily Express. By cozying up to the Pope, Putin is taking aim at the EU and its dominant humanistic philosophies. Vladimir Putin shoots glares at Juncker as the EU leaders air his problems with Russia at the G20. Jean-Claude Juncker at this G20 conference kind of surprised Putin when he held a separate press conference and talked about the big problems between the European bloc and Russia. And the president of the European Commission faced a very frosty reception from Putin when there was another press conference set up between the two of them. Speaking on the sidelines at the G20 summit, Juncker said the problem between the EU and Russia were well known, Crimea and eastern Ukraine. However, the European Commission wants to continue efforts so as to have opportunities for cooperation and perhaps points of overlapping interest with Russia. But at that press conference, you can see the glare that Putin has given to Juncker here. And don't you know that those translators on both sides of those men are sweating bullets, making sure they say exactly what they need to and nothing more. The press conference was notable for its cold atmosphere and tense body language between the pair who spoke through translators. The EU Commission and the Kremlin confirmed Juncker wrote a letter to Putin, and this was after the G20 summit. It was kind of like, let's make up, Putin. So after that meeting, Juncker wrote to Putin, looking for opportunities to build closer ties between the 28 EU nations, 27 now, depending on where Britain is, and an economic bloc that's led by Russia. Juncker reportedly told Putin that he had asked the Commission officials to study options to bring the EU closer to the Eurasian Economic Union, a newly formed trade bloc led by Russia, along with Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. The European Commission president apparently wrote the letter after that summit as somewhat of an apology. So Juncker tried to improve relations between the European Union and Russia and its bloc, which he stated, which is my regret, I have not been able to develop over the past year. Well, this idea of a closer relationship with Russia does not sit well for several of the EU member nations, in particular those on the eastern side. Lithuanian foreign minister said that letter sent to Putin surprised him and stated it did not reflect the EU member states and made no reference to the sanctions against Russia over its annexation of Crimea and a destabilization in the Ukraine. This only demonstrates the disunity that exists in the EU currently. This Juncker controversy was even worse when at a meeting in Germany, he said that the EU must improve relations with Russia and not to let the United States influence policy. We must make efforts towards a practical relationship with Russia. Well, part of that's that's a result because of what Trump has told the EU and NATO in many cases. We're not paying for it anymore. You guys are going to have to come up and put some money in. Final thought here. Pope Francis, rethinking Europe. The follow-up is in your hands. This is an event that occurred in October of last year and is reported on Web News. And I want you to note in particular on that logo what's at the center of the focus of what would have been the EU flag. It was organized by the Pope and an organization called COMSI. the Commission of Bishops Conference, and the European Union. Rethinking Europe took place between October 27th and 29th of this past year, and it was marked by the 60th anniversary of the signature of the Treaty of Rome. Hundreds of high-level church and EU political representatives, together with other leaders, met at the Vatican to contribute to a constructive reflection on the fundamental challenges facing the European project. Like we've said, a lot of turmoil right now going on. So Pope Francis presided at the closing ceremony of this conference, and here's his final thought. Christians are called to promote political dialogue, to restore dignity to politics, and to view politics as a lofty service to the common good. Where's the separation of church and state in that statement? It's not there. So, what is this Catholic organization's purpose? The Catholic Church and the European Union, the Conference of Bishops. Well, there, that's their primary purpose, to monitor the political processes of the European Union and the legal developments in the areas of interest in the Church. This is pursued through regular contacts with EU policymakers, members of the European Parliament, senior EU civil servants, with the aim of communicating to the European institutions and authorities the opinions and the views of the Bishops' Conference of the Member States concerning European integration in light of social doctrines of the Church, to offer them the cooperation and the service of the Church, and also to respond to their questions and problems. Are they involved in politics? So, it's interesting that there are several supporting organizations to this bishop's conference. You won't find them listed on this COMSEE website. One of those organizations is the Jesuits in Europe. Do we remember about the Jesuits? Remember the foundation? 1534, Ignatius of Loyola started to form this order. By 1540, the Pope approved it, sanctioned it as an order. What was one of the first things they did? We want to help to educate the people. So from 1540 to 1556, when Ignatius of Loyola died, they already had 74 colleges set up in Europe to educate the people, in particular the young people. Today they have over 100 more colleges. So, it says the Society of Jesus today, the service of faith and the promotion of justice are intimately linked. There is no service of faith without a social component, which includes ecological awareness and involvement. Jesuits and their co-workers, they're building an army. Jesuits and their co-workers are involved in all kinds of social outreach. And it goes on to say that reflecting on how to promote justice in our continent, 5 European networks are being set up by the Jesuits to help people, to help the lay people in these fields. Well, one of these organizations is the Jesuits European Social Center. Their office is in Brussels, Belgium. What other organization is in Brussels, Belgium? The EU. Real close to them. But what about the mission of this group? Our core mission at JESC is to reflect on the life, policies, and practices of the European Union, to advocate for justice of the European political structure, to seek critical but constructive engagement with the EU. That last paragraph, as a work of the Jesuits Conference of the European Provincials, JESC expresses the commitment of the Society of Jesus to a Europe where human rights, freedom, solidarity are the foundation of the integration. Doesn't that sound like liberty, equality, fraternity? Another group, another network that they formed called Faith and Politics. And this network holds workshops, in particular for young people across Europe. And note some of the underlined areas there. Invite young people from across Europe to explore the fascinating link between faith and politics, to explore Christian engagement in public life. They're building an army to get in these political positions to make sure church policy and church direction is adhered to. Note public service down at the bottom. Justice depends on a people who generously respond to a personal call to work and for others as stewards of creation. We want to put our people in political positions. So, would you say the Catholic Church is involved in politics? Because this is going to be applicable to another point we're going to get to later. Well, anyway, what does this all mean? The dragon, the beast, and the false prophet are not in accord yet. The croakings of the frogs, like spirits, has not reached that point of unmelodious harmony. Well, let's talk about the dragon. We read about him in Ezekiel 38 and verse 14 to 16. Therefore, son of man, prophesy and say unto Gog, thus saith Adonai Yahweh, in that day when my people of Israel dwelleth confidently, shalt thou not know it? And thou shalt come from thy place out of the north parts, thou and many people with thee, all of them riding upon horses, a great company and a mighty army. And thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against the land. And that's highlighted for a particular reason, because of a false understanding, not only amongst the Jews, but amongst Christadelphians as well, that the heathen may know me when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes. We get in our mind's eye this massive military force, guns locked and loaded, a great company and a mighty army, covering the land like a cloud. We connect it to Daniel chapter 11, the description of the king of the north, who comes with chariots and horsemen and many ships, and the king of the north shall enter the glorious land. Well, true, as they enter the land of Israel. But Gog didn't come into Syria like a whirlwind. They came in to help its reigning dictator, and they are now permanently in the land of Syria. They have a military seaport there that's been leased for another 74 years. And Russia has been given territorial sovereignty of that seaport, which means if it's attacked, it's no different than attacking Russia. So they're developing air bases, and they're playing right into Yahweh's plan. One article pointed out five reasons why Russia is in Syria. And one of the primary reasons is something you might hear from a realtor. Location, location, location. Syria's geography matters. In addition to that naval base, they've added additional Air Force bases. Syria now provides Iran, or Persia, with the Persian Navy's only direct Mediterranean access. Just to bring out and consider Russia's position in Syria, Note where its air bases are, predominantly in the south. Tartus, you can see it along the coast. That's their Navy base. It's being expanded as well. Latakia, a little bit further to the north on the coast, is the principal port city of Syria. And we note there's a Russian Air Force base fairly close to it. It won't be long before Russia is using that port as well. Remember Daniel's description of the king of the north? And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come up against him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and with many ships, him being Turkey, and shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. Notice, and it says, with many ships. There's a new navy in the Mediterranean, a new naval power, Russia. On December 11th of last year, Putin said Russian forces were withdrawing from Syria. February 4th of this year, Russia announced they were adding 4 more air bases and an additional 6,000 men. It's kind of interesting when you consider the mythological description of dragons. They're described as being serpentine or snake-like. Revelation 20 describes the dragon as that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan. Brother Thomas describes it as sin manifested politically. In character, they're proud, lofty, very confident of themselves. They're elusive and deceptive. How fitting. Who knows what we'll find next? Putin is in discussions with Erdogan, president of Turkey, about selling them the S-400 air defense system. And in order for that sale to go through, which I believe it has, Turkey had to agree to allow Russia to establish a military base in Turkey. Well, what about Persia, Gog's ally? This is from Fox News in February. Syria is building another base. And if we look at the setup, the Iranian military commander has set up 5 fronts in Syria. And note how many of these Persian bases are in the east and the south of Syria, just as the Russian bases are. So just that we note the size of the Persian army, the Syrian army is composed of 50,000 men. Persian army is 60 to 73,000 men. And the Israeli intelligence has just said that it's more like 80,000 men in Syria. Bigger presence in Syria than Syria's own army. So with this Iranian buildup, we begin to see the foundation of what Ezekiel comes to describe Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them. Persia's sitting there right now. More to come. So you have to wonder, how does Israel view this? This is from Breaking Israeli News. It was the headline for February 13th of this year. Israel and Iran have made direct military contact. That happened on February 10th, the Sabbath. For the first time, it signaled a significant escalation in a multinational engagement in Syria. The article went on to state, this development contains unique elements that several end-of-day experts say presages the Messianic War of Gog and Magog. The confrontation on Saturday marked a serious escalation in an already volatile region that brings the armies of many nations in closer proximity with one another. This explosive mix is coming to a boil, and it came to a boil last week when 2 other aircraft were shot down. One aircraft was a Turkish plane, and another was a Russian close support attack plain. One Jewish rabbi commented, "In many aspects, the situation in Syria conforms to the description in the prophecies of the war of Gog and Magog." Rabbi Winston told Breaking Israeli News, "What happened on the Sabbath could easily be the trigger to set off a war. Shooting down an airplane, especially inside Israeli airspace, as was the case with the Israeli F-16, is an act of war." And that was the first Israeli plane shot down in 35 years. The rabbi noted that the war of Gog and Magog is supposed to begin in the north, but that one essential factor mentioned in Ezekiel and hinting to Iran's role had been missing up to now. And I think I would give credit to a rabbi here for recognizing the nearness of Messiah's advent. And he quotes Ezekiel 38:4-5. Though exciting some rabbis to think that this is the war of Gog and Magog, there is one clear thinker, Rabbi Yosef Berger. He noted that the developing situation in Syria differs from the war of Gog and Magog, as described by the prophets, in at least one significant aspect. The prophet says that the war will be fought inside Israel and will reach Jerusalem. No sooner did this rabbi publish this statement than another rabbi, who happened to be his son, stated that as an act of mercy to the Jews, the war will not be fought in Israel. This erroneous understanding, and those similar to it, are now being published in Christadelphian magazines, magazines that were once a source of a correct understanding of prophetic events. One final topic on the dragon. Joel wrote, "Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles. Prepare war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong." Many nations will be vexed and be drunk with that strong delusion. Our Lord prophesied of wars and rumors of wars prior to AD 70. Once again, we find the same condition on the earth, preparatory to our Lord's manifestation. Swords and spears are now lasers and hypersonic missiles, weapons of slaughter and destruction that only a carnal mind could conceive of. Y'all remember that chart? Brother Mac showed it at the Bible school last year. It's from Detka File, which is the Israeli intelligence news site. Detka already knew that Russia was testing these hypersonic weapons. They were paying close attention, like most other nations. Hypersonic travel to many was believed to be science fiction, years away from development. Well, March 1st of this year, Putin made his grand announcement of 6 fantastic new weapons, all capable of traveling at hypersonic speeds and unstoppable by any U.S. technology. Israel knew what Gog was up to, and quietly, without any fanfare, unlike Putin, they've been developing an answer. Israel has an array of air defense systems specialized against a variety of missiles. Iron Dome against short-range missiles. David Sling to intercept medium to long-range missiles. And finally, the Arrow for long-range interception. And that Arrow system, by the way, is now being tested by the U.S. military in Alaska, finally showing an interest in Israeli technology. In April, 3 surface-to-air missiles were fired against Israeli aircraft, and they were successfully intercepted by the Arrow system, the first time the system was deployed. David Sling is their newest system, which was for the medium-range interception. And Netanyahu at a ceremony said, "It has immense significance for Israel's security, and I would like to praise the people of the Defense Ministry, the IDF, research and development, and all other elements that acted to enable this system to be operational. We are defending the home front. We are defending the home front. Note the advertisement down there at the bottom. Their emphasis on our shield. So what? Where's Yahweh? Israel is placing its arm of strength in itself, not God. And all we have to do is look back on Israel's history and how often were they successful in war when they didn't seek Yahweh's help. And we hear words in Christadelphian publications again describing how Israel as a nation is becoming more religious. But where are they putting their trust? So Christadelphians in both communities are beginning to believe, therefore, the people of the nation might be spared. Falsehood. We thought it rather interesting. Current census data in Israel reveals that 30% of the Jewish population in the land count themselves as religious. Contrast that with what Zechariah 13 says about how many will be left in the land after Gog invades. Where were David's thoughts? David said, "Some trust in chariots, some in horses, but we will remember the name of Yahweh." All right, the beast. The croaking of the beast. To many Europeans today, Europe is a military weakling. It has looked this way before only to surprise the world with its strength. One nation's working behind the scenes to bring European armies together, and it's swallowing entire armies and bringing foreign soldiers under its control without firing a shot. And the Western media don't seem to take much of an interest in it. This nation is quietly building a massive new military power in Europe. France is the nation that talks the most about a European military. But it's another nation that's doing the real work, Germany. This is from a fact sheet that Europe put out on what they call PESCO. This was put out in November of last year. Towards more security for the EU and its citizens. Permanent structured cooperation or the EU army. Note particularly the statement on the chart, in light of changing security environments. This was just the EU's polite way of saying, we don't need the US or Great Britain anymore, though we'll put up a facade of mutual cooperation. Europe does not need NATO and an EU army. They only need one. And here's what the frogs are croaking. Angela Merkel. She told an election rally in Germany that Europe must take fate in its own hands after an unsatisfactory G7 talk. And that's where Trump told them, you guys need to ante up if you want to be part of NATO. Jean-Claude Juncker, we have a lot to thank the Americans for, but they won't look after Europe's security forever. We have to do this ourselves, which is why we need a new approach to building a European security union with the end goal of establishing a European army. The German defense minister is working behind the scenes to bring European armies together. What is disturbing is Germany is bringing in soldiers from neighboring nations under its command. These are the member nations of PESCO, 25 of the current 27 member nations. But listen to some of the organizational structure. 2/3 of the land force personnel of the Netherlands, the great majority of the country's armed forces, will be under German authority. These soldiers will serve in German brigades under German commanders. They're becoming part of the German army. The Czech Republic is integrating one of its two combat brigades into the German army. Romania is signing over a mechanized brigade to Germany. And these are far from token forces. A brigade is around 1,500 to 4,000 men. Why is Germany taking the lead in creating a European military? Well, Germany has a reputation of doing this in peacetime. After World War I, the Treaty of Versailles limited the size of the German armed forces. And though it was closer to the beginning of the World War II before Germany broke the Treaty of Versailles, in actuality, it began quietly violating that agreement almost immediately. In 1922, Germany and Russia signed a treaty, the Treaty of Rapallo. On the face of it, the treaty was a fairly standard diplomatic reconciliation between two former enemies, just like the Treaty of Versailles. But it contained a secret clause. Germany would carry out military research, development, and training in Russia. In exchange, Russia would share the military advances and train with the German army. Well, the German military grew, and the world was oblivious until September 1st, 1939, when Germany invaded Poland. At the end of World War II, Germany was not allowed to have an army, but they turned a blind eye to that as well, and led by ex-Nazis, by the end of the 1950s, Germany had a force of 40,000 men and 2,000 officers. This is what a map of PESCO nations looks like. What's rather distressing is when we make a comparison. On the left, we have PESCO. On the right, we have Nazi Europe in 1942. Instead of conquering neighboring countries in open warfare, as it attempted to do in two world wars, Germany ultimately is integrating them diplomatically under its own command. For Israel, this has to be disturbing. This next topic, a very EU coup, Martin Selmayr's astonishing grab of power. You talk about political intrigue, this is it. This is a rather interesting event that occurred March 10th of this year. And it deals with the organization of that beast system. It's an article in the British News Service, from the British News Service, called The Spectator. And it's about how a German bureaucrat seized power in 9 minutes. Juncker and Selmayr. Selmayr, the German lawyer, is an EU zealot. He's always dreamed of being known beyond that little group in Brussels. It has arrived in the form of a brilliantly executed coup that handed this 47-year-old German bureaucrat near total control of the EU machine. The coup began at 9:39 on February 21st, when 1,000 journalists were sent an email summoning them to a 10:30 press conference with Jean-Claude Juncker. Short notice suggested urgency. And Juncker does not normally have very many press conferences, so they figured this was something important. His news was the surprise promotion of Martin Selmayr, his chief of staff, to the position of Secretary General, in charge of the Commission's 33,000 staff members. No one had been aware of a vacancy in the position of Secretary General. There was no sign that the 61-year-old current Secretary General from the Netherlands was thinking of retiring or quitting. But as Juncker announced other appointments, it quickly became clear what had happened. Selmayr had taken control, and anyone who resisted him, remember he was the monster, or is the monster, anyone who resisted him had been unceremoniously fired. Juncker had handed the keys of the European House to his favorite Eurocrat. Many members of the EU began to wonder between Juncker and Selmayr who was serving who. Rather than just being a regular chief of staff, Selmayr acted like a de facto deputy president. Juncker, who looks increasingly tired and worn out, had been a perfect love puppet for Selmayr. He was happy to let this chief of staff do the work and happy to thank him by giving him an even greater power. From chief of staff to secretary general of the EU Commission. In the first few days of his new job, Selmayr left no doubt about how he intended to rule. All commission staffers were sent a letter. Very unusual for the secretary general to send a letter. Normally it was always done by the president. So we know who was running things. He wrote that the EU civil servant must not be satisfied with being the machine to run our institution, but that is the job of the EU Commission. Selmayr declared that civil service, or rather he himself, would act as the heart and soul of the Commission. And with that sentence, Selmayr reduced the role of 28 European commissioners to mere extras. One commissioner who was present at that meeting where Selmayr was promoted explained what happened. They were called together at 9:30, where Juncker presented them with nominations for various positions that were open. He named Selmayr as Deputy Secretary General, a post that was known to be vacant. Selmayr's promotion was unexpected, but Juncker assured them that this was all above board. Then came the crowning blow. Having appointed Selmayr as Deputy Secretary General, Juncker announced that the Secretary General had resigned. So Selmayr, having been deputy for a few minutes, would now take the place on March 1st as the Secretary General. 9 minutes was all it took. Totally stunning, one commissioner stated. We've witnessed an impeccably prepared an audacious power grab. Before anyone else could find out about this double promotion, the email was sent out summoning the journalists, held a press conference, stating that Selmayr was confirmed and it was a fait accompli, a thing accomplished and irreversible. So, you wonder, why are the European commissioners not making a greater fuss about this? Well, perhaps it's because Selmayr is proposing to give them a special present. A retiring commissioner is entitled to a generous transition allowance up to 2/3 of their basic salary for 2 years. That's about $200,000 a year. Selmayr now plans to extend this to 3 years or possibly 5 years. On top of the extra cash, they'd enjoy a series of benefits. They would be given an office at the commission headquarters, which is normally reserved for the retired commissioner, or presidents rather, not commissioners. They'd be given a company car with a driver and two assistants. And keep in mind, all of that's tax-free. Only one mystery remains. Why did Selmayr do this? Why not wait? Juncker would only be president till October of next year. Why not stay as chief of staff? Or why not at least spend 6 months as deputy secretary general? One answer is that Selmayr had to move before anyone could figure out what was going on. France, in particular, had eyes set on that secretary general job. So now three of the four great European institutions, the Parliament, the diplomatic service, and now the European Commission, are managed by Germans. The European Parliament there is made up of representatives from the member nations. Germany has 96 representatives. The next highest number is France with 74 representatives. The European Commission is in charge of executing the laws, which is where Selmayr is now. And it's where he's gaining a great deal of power. three of the four great European institutions. Selmayr is now accountable to no one. Indeed, he has lost no time further consolidating his power. He moved his office closer to the president and continues to chair the meetings in the president's office. He even plans to put the hitherto independent European Legal Service under his command. So all he needs now is a new president just as docile as Juncker. And he'll have achieved his aim. Before his 50th birthday and without ever having stood for election, Selmayr will become the alpha and omega of the European Commission. And there's a great deal of trouble going back and forth now between the Parliament and the European Commission. The Parliament wanted Selmayr to back out of it. And Juncker said, if he does, I'll quit. And they're afraid of getting egg in their face. So everything right now stands as it is. Selmayr is in charge. All right, the false prophet. March of last year, 27 European Union leaders met with Francis in an ornate marbled hall in the Vatican City on a Friday evening. That gathering was ahead of the formal celebration on Saturday of the Treaty of Rome, which we know is the foundation of the EU. Just to reflect on a great irony of the Europe and the Pope, the beast and the false prophet, just the year before, in 2016, Pope Francis received the prestigious Charlemagne Prize. The International Charlemagne Prize of Aachen. Aachen is a city in Germany. It's been awarded since 1950 for work done in service to the European unification and peace. There's Aachen. And why Aachen is of any significance? It's because that's where Charlemagne lived. Previous recipients included top European politicians, chancellors, even a U.S. president. Germany's oldest prize for European policies is very prestigious. And the ceremony brings together prominent political leaders and dignitaries of every nation. The prize is named for Charlemagne, the Frankish king who became the first emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, the two-horned beast of the earth. He was and is revered as the father of Europe. His capital was in Aachen, Germany. This was his capital, where he's buried, where the prize originated, and where kings were crowned. The prize committee statement on Pope Francis as the recipient of the 2016 Charlemagne Prize was, at a time when the European Union is facing the greatest challenge of the 21st century, it is the Pope from the ends of the world, he's from Argentina, who orientates millions of Europeans to what European Union brings together at its core, a valid system of values, respect for human dignity and civil liberties, the uniqueness of human beings, whatever their ethnic, religious, or cultural background, and respect for creation, theistic evolution. The Pope urged Europe to stand together, telling the European Parliament and Europeans to hold on to their values and avoid falling back into nationalism. Nationalism is a big problem for the EU right now. Well, we remember from history that the Pope called the Franks to protect them from the Lombards in Italy, because the Lombards were going to topple the Pope. The Lombards were defeated by the Franks, and Charlemagne began a close, mutually beneficial tie to that holy see, as the little horn with eyes of Daniel 7 is known. In Rome, on Christmas Day in the year 800, Pope Leo III crowned the Franconian king as the first Western European emperor. Note that it was not in Aachen, where the Franks were normally crowned as kings. It was done in Rome. Gibbon records that Rome, from that time, was revered by the Latins as the metropolis of the world and the throne of popes and emperors, who from the eternal city derived their title, their honors, and the right or exercise of temporal dominion. The interdependence between the empire and the papacy was to influence European politics for centuries to come. Dutch Welle, German news service. Dutch Welle at this ceremony broadcasted, "Today the Pope no longer has a hand in worldly politics." What was that event we talked about earlier? "All he rules is the square kilometer of the Vatican, which is a member, not a member of the European Union, but has open borders to Italy and uses the euro." What amazes us is the blindness of the EU, its people, its news broadcasters, its leaders, as to how degrading and abasing Charlemagne having to come to Rome to be crowned was. Repeated with Charlemagne's prize, the same thing happened again in 2016. The German news service got it wrong. The Pope still has a hand in worldly politics. As there was a pilgrimage to Rome in AD 800, there was another one in 2016 AD. While the Pope is happy to receive the prize, he wasn't coming to Aachen for the ceremony, just like where the kings were crowned in Charlemagne's day. The excuse was that the prize was normally awarded on Ascension Day, which is on a Thursday. Since Pope Francis is busy on this Catholic holiday, which, by the way, is also a public and therefore a federal holiday in 13 of the 28 EU nation members, the prize committee and a throng of European politicians headed to the Vatican instead, since Pope Francis was too busy. Another novelty. The award ceremony took place in the Sala Regia, the regal room, at the Apostolic Palace a day later on Friday. Three former recipients who represented the EU institutions delivered the tribute. The European Parliament President, Martin Schulz, German. The Commission President, Jean-Claude Juncker. And the European Council President, Donald Tusk. Dutch Welle, the German news service, really got it wrong. What image is presented to the world in this picture that you're looking at up there on the overhead? A humble man of the cloth, bowing his head in the presence of such an ornate group. I see a very deceptive image. All eyes looking to the center, to the one who ceremonially appoints regal authority. He sits in power on a throne for all to view, clad in pure white, denoting his purity of character. He sits below the papal seal emblazoned with the two keys of the kingdom given to the popes and the three-crowned papal tiara symbolizing Father of Kings, Governor of the World, and Vicar of Christ. The strength of the papacy sitting on his right hand, the church authority. On his left hand, in a more subservient position, the political strength of the beast system. And below, note that, below Francis, sits the leaders of the beast nations, assembled, looking up, and giving honor to the false prophet. As you look at that image, your mind might go to Revelation 13. "And he deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on earth that they should make an image to the beast, which had been wounded by a sword and did live." The false prophet is hard at work bringing the nations of Europe together, once again to resurrect the beast of the earth that will contend with the Son of God. As we await our Lord's return, watching the signs and the times, we leave you with the thoughts of one of our pioneer brethren. Brother John Thomas, 1848, wrote, Let us believe nothing that comes from the pulpit, the altar, or the press, not demonstrated by the grammatical sense of the Scriptures. Let us be contented with nothing less than a thus it is written and a thus saith the Lord. For he has laid it down in his law that no one is worthy of belief who does not speak after this rule to the law and to the testimony. If they speak not according to this word, it's because there is no light in them.